Here's a look at our top story this hour. Turkey accuses the Kurdistan Workers' Party, PKK, of being behind a bomb attack in a major Istanbul street that left six people dead and scores of others wounded. Israeli forces kill yet another Palestinian in the occupied West Bank, this time fatally shooting a woman while she was driving a car in the town of Beitounia. Also, the U.S., South Korea, and Japan vow a strong response in case of a seventh nuclear test by North Korea amid tensions following the recent drills between Washington and Seoul. Hello and welcome to World News from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you for joining us. The latest on the deadly bomb attack in Turkey's Istanbul, the Interior Ministry says police have detained 22 suspects, including the woman who planted the bomb. The ministry is blaming militants of the Kurdistan Workers' Party for the blast, saying the order for the attack was given in Kobani. That's a city in northern Syria where Turkish forces have carried out operations against the Kurdish militants in recent years. There's been no claim of responsibility yet. The attack left at least six people dead and more than 80 others wounded. The blast occurred on the busy Istiklal Street in Taksim area, which is popular with locals and tourists. Istanbul and other Turkish cities have in the past been targeted by Kurdish separatists and Daesh terrorists. Our Istanbul correspondent, Roshan Saklam, joined us earlier with more on the potential culprits behind the explosion.
He also said that the officials were able to know that a woman was the one who placed the explosive device in Istiklal Street, where the bombing took place. And he said that they were able to know the perpetrators and they will reveal information very soon. He also said that we will not allow those terrorists to reach their goals in Turkey, and we will be able to make this nation safe again. Right before Erdogan was speaking, we heard gunshots in an area that is very close to Istiklal Street. It's called Shishhana. It is exactly where actually Press TV office is. The gunshots were heard for like a few minutes, and the police was in the area. So I think that probably this could be they could be following the suspect. Since they revealed that the suspect was a woman, I think that is most likely that those perpetrators behind what happened today is the Kurdistan Workers' Party, PKK, because as we all know that Kurdistan Workers' Party is known that mainly the suicide bombers, the fighters in it, half of them is females. So they're mainly women, and a lot of them have been involved in explosions or attacks that took place inside Istanbul.
Turning now to the occupied West Bank, where Israeli atrocities show no sign of abating. The regime forces have killed yet another Palestinian in western Ramallah. Troopers shot dead the Palestinian woman in the town of Beitounia. It happened as they opened fire on a car the victim was riding in. Other passengers of the vehicle have been arrested. The Israeli military also separately arrested nine people in raids across the occupied West Bank. The regime has recently intensified its deadly crackdown in the region. The campaign has left more than 140 Palestinians dead this year alone. Our correspondent Mona Kandil was with us from Ramallah for more on the killing of the young Palestinian woman in the occupied West Bank. Take a listen.
Israeli forces have already raided Beitounia city, and when they saw the vehicle there, they opened fire at the vehicle, killing the Palestinian girl. And they claimed that there were two inside the vehicle and they arrested them. It's not clear if that's true, if the two who were arrested were inside the vehicle or not, but we know that a female Palestinian was shot dead. According to paramedics, she could be 19 or 20 years old. The identity of this girl is not known yet. She was transferred to Palestinian hospital in Ramallah. The Israeli forces have already raided several areas across the occupied West Bank and arrested a number of Palestinians. The Israelis had issued a statement claiming that early morning, Israeli soldiers were surprised by a Palestinian vehicle approaching the forces who stormed Bitunia City, and that's why the soldiers opened fire. But according to the video, it was clear that the vehicle didn't even approach the raiding soldiers. They themselves who opened fire at the corner.
Israel has carried out a deadly missile strike against Syrian military positions in the country's central province of Homs. Syrian media say two soldiers were killed in the latest aggression targeting the Shayrat air base southeast of Homs. Three others were also injured, according to Syrian media. The country's air defense systems intercepted most of the missiles. The Israeli regime frequently launches missile attacks inside Syria, but rarely claims responsibility. The attacks mainly target the Syrian military, as well as resistance fighters battling foreign-backed terrorists. Damascus has repeatedly complained to the United Nations about Israel's raids, calling for international action and condemnation of the violation of its sovereignty and territorial integrity. Another U.S. citizen has been arrested in Saudi Arabia after getting into a dispute with security officials while performing the Hajj pilgrimage. Mohammed Salem, an American of Yemeni origin, was taken into custody in Mecca on November 1st for making remarks critical of the monarchy. The 63-year-old has been transferred to a maximum security facility typically used for high-profile political prisoners and suspected terrorists. There is no information whether the man has been charged. Last month, another U.S. citizen of Saudi origin was sentenced to 16 years in prison. That apparently because of his Twitter posts on topics including the war in Yemen and the 2018 killing of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Bahrainis have voted in parliamentary elections. This may sound like a very positive development, but nothing could be further from the truth. For how could there be a free and fair election when all the opposition groups have been disbanded or crushed? Since 2011, the Bahraini uprising began and has not stopped till this day.
Bahrain has held its general elections. The regime was delighted. Authorities in the Sunni-ruled state, which crushed a 2011 anti-government uprising, said that the vote was free and put the turnout at 73%. But the vote was anything but free and fair. Rights groups called the voting environment of what is supposed to be a democratic process as political repression. They said there were highly restrictive measures that barred members of banned opposition groups. They added holding this general election will not address the atmosphere of repression and the denial of human rights that has gripped Bahrain for years. This, in essence, would make the vote a sham, that it would be void of holding any value. It was no surprise that Bahrainis took to the streets to protest the electoral process and announce that they would boycott the election, since it served the political trajectory of the ruling class. Bahrain experienced an uprising in 2011, still ongoing till this day, in which the Bahraini regime dissolved the main opposition groups and cracked down on dissent. The regime's crackdown over the past 12 years has been brutal. According to a 61-page report, the court is satisfied with the confession. Bahrain death sentences follow torture, sham trials. The regime has arbitrarily arrested more than 20,000 and tortured more than 6,000 victims. This also includes extrajudicial killings of more than 200 and political death sentences, the dissolution of opposition political societies, and the demolition of 38 mosques. And this is happening in a Persian Gulf country that is a key ally of the U.S. in the region, home to the U.S.'s Navy's Fifth Fleet, and also the United Kingdom, which opened a permanent military base in 2018.
The Bahraini regime's suppression of its Shia citizens and stripping them of their rights, in addition to the jailing and torturing of the opposition members, forced the regime to make a major decision. In October of this year, it withdrew from the Human Rights Council, which was one more nail in the coffin of its commitment to protecting human rights. Government critics saw that as a sign that since it was no longer a member, it would feel free to continue its crackdown.
The powerful Shia cleric Shariz al-Qassam has said that the election means normalization. He said the elections constitute a test of the populace's awareness, explaining that to elect means opening the door for Bahraini citizenship-bearing Israelis to vote for parliament members. This would translate into how the electorate, meaning soldiers, dual citizens, security forces, those with personal interests in mind, and normalization advocates, would create a parliament for the government and not the people. The double standard approach by the UK and the US stands out when it comes to the issue of human rights and Bahrain. After all, Bahraini courts have convicted and sentenced defendants to death following manifestly unfair trials based solely or primarily on confessions, allegedly coerced through torture and ill treatment. The governments of the US and the UK, as well as the European Union and its member states, should urge Bahrain, through both public and diplomatic channels, to halt all executions and to seriously investigate torture allegations and violations of the right to a fair trial. Yet they have chosen to do that with other countries, for example, Iran, which ironically has rioters out on the streets, endangering Iran's national security. According to Iran's intelligence minister, both the US and the UK even have a hand in the deadly protests, like to the CIA. A recent visit of the Pope to Bahrain posed an opportunity for the plight of Bahrainis to be addressed. 130 human rights organizations appealed to the Pope of the Vatican to demand the release of prisoners of conscience in Bahrain. They asked him to adopt an initiative urging the Bahraini authorities to end violations. But those hopes are dim. These 130 human rights organizations have cited how so many Bahrainis have faced discrimination, jail time, and torture. Yet Bahrain has always shifted the blame to Iran for the unrest. Could 130 human rights organizations be wrong, or for them to be lying? But Bahrain ultimately cannot have a democratic process because its big brother Saudi Arabia, which is just a stone's throw away, will be threatened by democracy taking place next door and will vehemently reject this, since it cannot risk having democracy creep into the kingdom. After all, Bahrain is joined only by a causeway to Saudi Arabia.
Yemen is facing an acute shortage of medical supplies as a Saudi-led coalition is impeding all sorts of imports by continuing its blockade on the country. Abdullatif Al-Washili reports from Sana'a.
The Yemeni Ministry of Health and Population held a press conference in Sana'a to highlight the impact of the continued Saudi siege on the national drug supply program. The event took place amid a severe shortage of necessary medication in the war-torn country.
The Saudi blockade imposed on the national drug supply program has caused one of the world's worst crises in the health sector. Medicines do not arrive on time at all due to the closure of Sana'a's international airport, which has also led to a high rate of death among people with chronic diseases. Patients can't receive basic drugs such as insulin for diabetics, and this is a tragedy no one talks about.
The ministry says almost 169,000 patients cannot receive life-saving medicine and they are in real danger unless the siege is lifted.
The pharmaceutical system in Yemen has been gripped by the Saudi blockade. International companies have partially or completely left the Yemeni market as they face extra costs as well as seizure of vessels for weeks and months. Moreover, medicines should be delivered in special conditions to maintain their quality and effectiveness. The fuel crisis has also negatively affected the shipment of medication.
Earlier, the member of the National Negotiating Delegation, Abdul Malik Al-Ajri, accused Western powers of preventing the entry of medical supplies into Yemen, saying this precedent has never been witnessed throughout history. Officials believe that Saudi Arabia is deliberately preventing medical supplies from entering Yemen to pressure Sana'a to accept the UN agreement as it is. They say the siege has failed throughout 7 years of the war, and the kingdom's measures will push the Yemeni army to carry out new airstrikes. Abdullatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Iran's IRGC has launched missile drone attacks against terrorist positions in Iraq's Kurdistan region. We will keep a close eye on that developing story, and we will give you further updates as soon as we get them. But for the time being, let's move on. The U.S. president says his country, Japan, and South Korea have never been more aligned in their stance against North Korea and its missile tests.
Japan and the Republic of Korea are both critical allies of the United States And for years, our countries have been engaged in a trilateral cooperation out of a shared concern for the nuclear and missile threats of North Korea poses to our people. And North Korea continues provocation for provocative behavior. This partnership is even more important than it's ever been.
Biden, Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida, and South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol issued a joint statement condemning the recent missile tests by North Korea. The trio met on the sidelines of an East Asian summit in the Cambodian capital. The three leaders vowed a, quote, strong and resolute response in case of a seventh nuclear test. Over the past week, North Korea has fired a barrage of missiles in response to Washington and Seoul carrying out the largest ever air drills on the peninsula. Pyongyang considers the military exercises as a rehearsal for an invasion. The U.S. and South Korea, however, say they are holding the drills in response to the North's possible plan to resume nuclear tests. The Ukrainian president says investigations have revealed that Russian troops committed hundreds of war crimes in Ukraine's Kherson region.
Investigators have already documented more than 400 Russian war crimes. Bodies of both civilians and military are being found. In the Kherson region, the Russian army left the same savagery behind as in other regions of our country, which it managed to invade. We will find and bring to justice every murderer without any doubts.
Zelensky stated that law and order have been restored in many areas in Kherson, where the hunt, as he said, was on for Russian soldiers and mercenaries. Meanwhile, he added that fighting in the eastern Donetsk region is as intense as it had been in recent days, with no let-up in Russian attacks. Zelensky also said Ukrainian forces' resilience and courage are at their highest level as they confront Russian troops. He said the Ukrainian military will not allow Russian forces to penetrate Ukrainian defenses. And with that, we'll come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran,
hello. Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company.
Sorry, how can I get to Nasuri Castle in Kangan?
This bus is heading to Nasuri Street, where the castle is located.
I'm from South Africa. Actually, I'm interested in Iran, its history, its culture, and of course its tourist attractions.
Great, so I'll let you know when we arrived.
Thank you very much for your help.
Nasuri Historical Castle is located in Kangan County in Bushehr Province, southern Iran. This castle dates back to the Qajarid era. This monument belongs to the Nasuri family, and they built it on a high hill overlooking the Persian Gulf. The building has two inner and outer courtyards, a royal residence, and a wind catcher. The materials used in this monument include plaster and mud. 18 beautiful paintings from the renowned Iranian poet Ferdowsi's Shahnameh are carved on the west porch of the castle. This building was built by Sheikh Jabbar II, the grandfather of Sheikh Nasser Nasuri, in the early Qajar period. This castle has been registered in Iran National Heritage List.
Nasuri Castle. Any passenger wants to leave off?
Oh, yes. Yes, sir. We get off here.
Great.
It's for the first time you've been here?
No, it's the second time. I have been to many Iranian cities. I've been to Tehran, Isfahan, Mashhad, and this time I've traveled to Shiraz and to Bushehr.
Oh, that's great. By the way, I'm seeing the castle. Look at there.
Thank you very much for your help. You Iranians are very hospitable.
Thank you.
Mamnoon. Mutshakkiram.
So here I arrived. This castle is situated on a hill which overlooks the Persian Gulf. The gate of the castle is on the south, towards the Persian Gulf. It's a wooden gate with carvings and stud welding. Let me go inside. after the main entrance, there is a vast vestibule. And look at there, an Ivan with stone columns, which have all beautiful plaster work. Oh, I love them. This Ivan stretches to a chamber through wooden gates. Very beautiful. You can't believe this chamber is decorated with plaster work. On the northern part, there is a staircase which I can go up to see the second floor. Wow, these columns are unique. I can't take my eyes off them. And let me go up the stairs. I can see a big, amazing wind catcher. This wind catcher used to make the air inside cool. And I believe wind catchers are a masterpiece of Iranian architecture. Did you like the castle?
It was extraordinary. Iran is a very unique country. It's really spectacular. By the way, would you please take a photograph of me?
Yes, of course. Give me your camera, please. Ready? 1, 2, 3.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
North Korea has been on a missile launch run lately. In one day, it tested fire 25 missiles. Why has North Korea been so aggressive when it comes to these launches? Is it to grab attention from the U.S.? Yet when it comes to North Korea, the U.S. President Joe Biden says the U.S., Japan, and South Korea are more aligned than ever on North Korea. Shouldn't they try to be more aligned with North Korea itself instead of among themselves, or at least with China? Just a few of the questions we'll be asking from our guests in this edition of The Spotlight. First, let me introduce our guests. Mike Billington is the editor at the Executive Intelligence Review, joins us from Hamilton, Virginia. Also joining us is Arnold August. He's an author and journalist who joins us from Montreal.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, welcome to you both, gentlemen. Mike Billington, I'll start with you. The amount of missiles that North Korea has launched is, in a sense, incredible. And one day, 25 missile tests were conducted. Why do you think that they feel that they have to launch so many missiles? What are they trying to say here?
Well, the obvious is that they're trying to demonstrate that they have the capacity to defend themselves and that they're willing to do so by attacking any source of attack from outside their borders. There may very well be other justifications which they have not made public.
Okay. Arnold August, let me ask you, in terms of the way that they have done this, analysts are saying that this is perhaps building to something bigger, like maybe a nuclear test, which the U.S. is anticipating, or a full long-range ballistic missile test out to be conducted to the Pacific, or both. Do you think that that is what North Korea is intending to do?
I think one has to look at North Korea similar to what Mike just mentioned from their own point of view, their own standpoint. It is quite obvious for some time, I would say, since the last meeting of the big powers in Madrid, NATO, last June, for the first time, NATO and the West specifically mentioned that, yes, we're concerned about Russia, but our main fear is is China. And then, of course, you had the very well orchestrated and deliberate sending by the Biden administration, Nancy Pelosi, to Taiwan. And since then, it's been escalating. Now, in that context, I think that North Korea has every right to have nuclear weapons to defend themselves. One could just imagine if they did not have these weapons to defend themselves against the United States, it's quite possible that North Korea would have been overthrown by this time. Let us take the example, if I'm not mistaken, Gaddafi, he gave up on the issue of nuclear weapons. What happened after that? The United States invaded the country, killed the legitimate leader of that country in Libya, and has been going downhill since. So I think people are perhaps have to learn from history and put things into context and not allow the mainstream media to focus, North Korea, they're bad. They tested missiles, but what is the context?
Mm-hmm. Well, if you can tell us, Mike Billington, whether these missile tests, along with the military exercises that the U.S. has conducted, whether it's with South Korea or with Japan, and also how it has been provoking China, such as providing, for example, Taiwan with arms, is all related, in a sense, to the way that North Korea has exercised these vast numbers of missile tests. I mean, are these things related?
Well, you know, everything is related in terms of the development of human history. The current global showdown, the global crisis being orchestrated virtually every day over many different aspects of the unfolding of history, the evolution of what has become a very near-term degeneration into global nuclear war centered around the Ukraine crisis. All these things are related. I think you really have to step back from the strategic nuclear confrontation, military threats, and so forth, it's required that you look at the global emergence of history as a from a single perspective in order to have a sense of what is going on in front of our eyes and what is rapidly escalating crisis situation that could become a war virtually overnight by intent or by mistake. That's the point of initiation of looking at this descent to a nuclear war. But on the other hand, you also have to have a broader perspective and recognizing that the Western financial system is disintegrating. We're sitting on top of the greatest explosion of the dollar-based Western financial system in history. And it's this that's driving the war rather than the other way around. The feeble and ridiculous effort by some of the Western financial moguls to say that the current Western financial disintegration is being brought about by Russia's taking its oil and gas off the markets is totally absurd. First of all, it's not Russia that took its oil and gas off the markets, but it also is trying to separate the energy crisis and the general economic breakdown crisis in the West from its reality, which is 30, 40 years of crazy speculative printing of money.
Right, right.
Dollars and other currencies.
Let's take a look at what Russia has said, actually, since you've mentioned Russia over here. Arnold August, Russian foreign minister, has said that the U.S. and NATO are militarizing the Southeast Asia region in order to contain the interests of Russia and China in the Asia Pacific. Now, I'm looking at that statement coming from the Russian foreign minister, and I'm asking you to whether you can put that into context for us when it comes to the way that actually the U.S. Has said that both Russia and China can exercise their influence on North Korea. You know, you have the U.S. on the one hand that obviously is not on good terms with Russia, nor with China, really, in a sense, accusing them of a variety and a host of issues, but yet they want to ask them to leverage their influence over North Korea. I mean, isn't that like having the cake and eat it too type approach by the U.S.?
Yes, it is. And I'd like to just add to that one point. Mike also said the necessity to look at the overall context and to dot the lines, dot the I's. So I would say, you know, we're looking at what region? It's a South China Sea. What is the key country in the South China Sea? There's only one, the People's Republic of China. And so, in my view, if you want to look into the context, the current offensive by the United States and its allies, including Canada and Europe, began, say, in 2014 in Russia when NATO launched its offensive to push Russia to the brink where it had no choice to defend itself against NATO incursions right on the border of Russia. And I have said that before, and I'll say it again. While it is obvious the main target on NATO and Western countries is Russia, but the ultimate goal of these countries is to weaken Russia, not just as a phenomenon as such, but as part of the growing alliance between Russia and China, which also includes many other countries, such as BRICS, which is exploding. Every time we have an interview here on Press TV, we talk about the number of countries that are joining BRICS. Well, since the last conference here, there's been several other countries joining. So my view is that everything that's happening, whether it's in Eastern Europe or in the South China Sea, the main target is China. And I would not say just to contain China, as the United States puts it diplomatically, but the United States is not interested in containing anything. Right from this very beginning, the United States wants to control completely the countries of the world that they want to dominate, and those countries that stand up to U.S. domination, whether the United States admits it or not, the ultimate goal is regime change. Their goal in Russia is regime change. They want to get Putin out in order to have a government that is compliant with the United States. And the same thing goes, it's hard for them to talk about regime change and China, forget about it, but they're going to try everything to destabilize China and make it difficult for it to continue on the path of major economic developments that the whole world can now see.
Well, the U.S. is benefiting from this, though, in some sense, Mike Billington, if you agree. I mean, at this point, you had this massive war games that the U.S. conducted with Japan. Japan is now intimidated, and it wants, next month, it has announced that the government is going to double the defense budget over the next decade, and it's going to acquire long-range strike weapons. And, of course, that's going to come from the U.S. Do you think that that is obviously one intention the U.S. has when it comes to North Korea vis-a-vis militarizing that region?
Yes, I think the answer is yes. The Western financial system is in a state of total bankruptcy, which is increasingly recognized around the world, and that there's no easy fix, no solution to the bankruptcy. And therefore, many in the West, the so-called war party, which includes people from all the political parties in the U.S., both the Republicans and Democrats, who believe that pushing for war is the only way to start the money pumping for the military-industrial complex, as well as the interplay between the national financial institutions in Europe, in the U.S., in the developing sector, the South American banking interests, the African financial institutions, and so forth. So in that sense, yes, the diverting of funds to the money trading centers in the financial institutions, the hedge funds and the other aspects of this, but in particular those that are tied to financing this war, which is, you know, demanding the printing of billions and billions, trillions even, of new credit being pumped out into the system. This is all interfaced. The Wall Street financier crowd and those who are making sure politically as well as financially that new credits are being issued regularly to finance the military-industrial complex. All of that is being waged full steam.
Okay. All right. So, you know, while Mike Billington was speaking there, Arnold August, I couldn't help but try to draw a comparison here, which I don't know if it's appropriate or not. So I'm going to ask you, when you take a look at the way that the U.S. is militarizing the region, we're looking at obviously some of the countries in particular like South Korea and Japan. It kind of looks like what it's doing in the area where Ukraine is. You know, you have all these NATO countries, and they're all being pumped with lots of weapons, with the threat being Russia. And here you have the threat being North Korea, and they seem to be ramping up that kind of approach. And interestingly, reports are suggesting that Japan is negotiating the purchase of these Tomahawk cruise missiles, which has the ability to strike targets deep inside China. So that seems to be in line with what they're doing in the Ukraine area. Is that an appropriate comparison?
I think it's more than appropriate, because what we're seeing now over the last few weeks, few days, is a NATO-style aggression led by the United States and their allies such as Canada and Europe against China. There's no doubt about it. With Taiwan, I guess one could say the proxy in this case is Taiwan, as Ukraine is the proxy against Russia in Eastern Europe. And I think it's important to analyze the fact that it was raised by Mike and yourself, like the whole issue of a currency that is outside of the control of the United States and Europe and Canada. This is a major breakthrough, a major project that is going on right as we speak. That's why I have to mention BRICS once again, that is burgeoning. And the main feature of BRICS, it has already started, and that is using currencies that are not American currency, even using credit cards that are not American credit cards. And this, I think, poses a very important danger to U.S. hegemony. And this, I would also say, amongst what the United States says are their closest allies in this latest provocation in the South China Sea, such as Japan and South Korea. Well, I saw millions of people demonstrating in South Korea against this type of militarization, and perhaps other countries as well. So the United States will not have it that easy, or not as easy, they think, to keep this coalition going against China, as they are, to a certain extent, much less extent, not able to really solidify all of the European countries behind the American pressures against NATO, if not the governments. Millions of people are demonstrating throughout Europe to get Europe out of NATO and stop American NATO arming of the Nazi regime in Ukraine. So there's a lot of things in play. Many things could come up in the next while. I will not be surprised if the United States may have some problem keeping control over South Korea and Japan.
Well, there's got to be something that needs to happen, because we're looking at how North Korea has conducted all these missile tests, Mike Billensing. At this point, do you think that the U.S. and its allies there are going to just have a wait-and-see type approach, or are they going to actually... I mean, what is the... it's confusing what strategy the U.S. is really using when it comes to North Korea. I mean, you had Jake Sullivan say the North Korean nuclear test would be a flagrant violation, were it to happen, of multiple U.N. Security Council resolutions. I mean, is that the best that the U.S. can do when it comes to North Korea?
I don't think anyone in the Biden government has any actual plan that has some positive outcome.
Okay, it looks like we may have lost. I'll ask that question from you. I'm sorry we just lost you there, Mark Billington, if you have us. Arnold August, same question to you in less than a minute, please.
Yeah. What, could you just repeat it rapidly?
Yeah, the U.S. approach towards North Korea. Are they going to wait and see what North Korea is going to do? Or are they going to lay out something that shows some logic behind anything that has to deal with North Korea?
I don't think the Biden administration has any plans at all with regards to that area of the world, aside from the long-term goal to destabilize China and eventually try to control it. So I don't think they have a plan. But they are forced to have a plan now, because the Koreans were courageous enough to respond to those drills right around their territory by firing their nuclear weapons as a warning, say, look, you are not entering Korea. We are ready to defend ourselves. The United States always has in their mentality that the other countries of the South eventually will bow down ally with the United States, but that is not going to happen with Korea, and it might not even happen in North Korea. It might not even happen with what they call are their allies in the South China Sea.
Thank you for that. Arnold August, author and journalist from Montreal. Mike Billington, thank you. Asia editor of the Executive Intelligence Review from Hamilton, Virginia. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tahwe and the team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. This is Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Ata, the host of this program. With me in the studio, we have a very special guest speaker from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Karimi. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
That's right, Sheikh Karimi. For today's discussion, we want to talk about the concept of istikhara and why do people lead with the Holy Quran. Let's first define istikhara. What is it?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The unfortunate point about istikhara is that what is common among the people is not the concept of, at least the main concept of istikhara, which has been taught by the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wassalam. The word istikhara means to ask for khair, to ask for goodness and blessing from someone. And when it comes to the concept of istikhara as a technical term, we do the same. We say istakhirullah or istakhartullah, meaning that I ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for goodness and for blessing. So what we mainly find in the narrations of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wassalam is that the concept of istikhara is to ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to make your work, your life, your job, whatever you are looking for, blissful and with barakah, with khair, with goodness. And in almost all the cases, the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt, they have encouraged the people to do so instead of doing what is common nowadays, istikhara through Quran and the tasbih and so on and so forth. This is not at least widespread in the narration. What we have in the narration is that when you have whether you have any doubt to do something or not. Mm-hmm. Are encouraged, you are highly recommended to ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for making that job blissful, with goodness, with barakah.
When you have no choice or you cannot decide for an important case.
No, it's not only limited to that. Okay. Even for any action that you want to do, we are highly recommended to do so. What is the concept of istikhara, for example? Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says that no one does istikhara from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for 70 times, except that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will give him blessing. Does it mean that istikhara through Quran? Not at all. This concept is not that much found in the narrations.
Yes.
Meaning that you are going to do something. You are going to begin, a new work. Anything. You want to, go out of your home early in the morning.
Yes.
You may read a supplication or some prayers. I will mention some of them. And then you ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that please make my day blissful. Please make my job full of blessing and goodness. So you ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for goodness. Whether you have any doubt or not, it doesn't make any difference. In another narration, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says that in the last sajda, prostration of your morning prayer, say do istikhara for 101 times. What does it mean? Does it mean that istikhara by Quran? No. Just say astakhirullah. Oh Allah, I ask you for khair, or I ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for khair, for barakah, and praise Allah and send salawat upon the Prophet and his family members. That's right. And the rest part of the narration. So in all these cases, let me just share one more narration from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, in which he says, whoever wants to begin any work, he or she should say a turak of prayer, then after the prayer they should praise Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, send salawat, and then to pray that, oh Allah, if there is any khair, any goodness, any blessing in this job, then please make it easy for me to do that. Otherwise, please prevent me from doing that.
That's right.
And the Imam says about the verses and the chapters to be recited in that prayer. This is one group of the narrations which is telling the people that ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for khair for any work, whether you have doubt or not.
Mm-hmm.
We have another group of narrations about the times when we have doubt and hesitation, whether we should begin the work, for example, we should do that work or not.
Cannot decide properly.
Exactly.
On a crucial point, okay?
In one narration, Ishaq ibn Ammar, this narration is quoted by Sheikh Hasaduq in Mala Yahdur al-Faqih. He says to Imam Sadiq alayhi salam that sometimes I'm about to do something, but I have some doubt whether I need to do that or not. Then the Imam says that if you have such a feeling, if this happens to you, just say two rak'ah of prayer and say astaghfirullah for 101 times, meaning that I ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for khair. And then look which side seems and looks better to you, and just do that one. In another narration, Ibn Asbad tells Imam al-Rida alayhi salam that sometimes we are going to go to a journey and the way is very dangerous and we are hesitating whether to go through a sea or through a land. And the Imam says that, Imam says some recommendations, and finally he says that just say a two rak'ah of prayer, and after the prayer you do istikhara, meaning that ask Allah for making this journey blissful and
that's
full
right.
of barakah for you,
okay.
And then decide to go through sea or land, whatever. So the narrations which are in the state of hesitation, doubt, mm-hmm. shak, are also encouraging the people to do so, instead
yes.
of consult what we are nowadays
okay.
call it consulting the Quran
yes.
or doing istikhara through tasbih. The concept of istikhara that is mainly mentioned by the Imam of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam are related to the literal meaning of istikhara,
yes.
asking for goodness.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Inshallah, 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 you'll find your way.
So whether we...
So this could be throughout reading any kind of supplication, or no, you have to open.